The headlines. Iran says the U.S. should be held accountable for the losses it inflicted on Tehran by its illegal withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal. The European Union says it will press ahead with plans to impose tariffs on up to $4 billion worth of U.S. goods and services. And the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, suffering from the U.S. cuts, says it lacks the funds to pay the salaries of its Palestinian employees. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Iran has ruled out any renegotiation regarding the 2015 nuclear agreement signed between Tehran and the world powers. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the agreement, known as the JCPOA, was the outcome of long-term talks between Iran, permanent members of the U.S. Security Council, and Germany. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Iran nuclear deal is a binding international agreement and that no one can set conditions to renegotiate it. The spokesman said that Washington has withdrawn from the accord. By doing so, has inflicted losses to the Iranian nation. He said the U.S. should be held accountable for those losses. Activist and international lawyer Barry Grossman says Washington is seeking to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal in order to decrease Israel's concerns.
Well, I think probably if you were to speak to the players privately, off the record, they would concede that talk of renegotiation is really quite absurd. And I guess what I would say is, the way Mr. Biden, should he manage somehow to pull this from the fire, the way he deals with the Iran issue will be the acid test for the bona fides of his administration. Having said that, I think it's very important to keep in mind that he's already spoken and without reservation declared his commitment to Israel. And certainly the entire JCPO process and everything that's followed has in no small part been driven by Israel and its feigned concerns about Iran. So I personally don't hold out any great hope that Biden would be able to find the political will, let alone the capability to go against those very powerful interests that would have him continue to stay the course that's been steered by Donald Trump in order to reach a resolution with Iran. At the very least, I would expect there to be an attempt at a very serious renegotiation. And of course, as I understand it, Iran quite properly will not be a part of that.
U.S. President Donald Trump is planning to hold rallies to question the outcome of the vote that gave his Democratic rival Joe Biden a clean sweep in the race for the White House. The Trump campaign spokesman said the president wants to build support for his fight over the election results. The incumbent president has not acknowledged defeat and has launched an array of lawsuits to press claims of election fraud in swing states without producing evidence. Trump has also lambasted the mainstream media for projecting Biden as a winner. That, as President-elect Biden has taken the first steps of a transition plan into the White House. He and VP-elect Kamala Harris have launched a transition website that lists their four priorities of COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. The transition website says that Biden is assembling a team to tackle the challenges on day one when he formally takes office. While U.S. media declared Joe Biden the winner of the presidential election, many Republicans remain divided whether to call the race over. Few within the Republican Party, including former President George Bush, congratulated Joe Biden's triumph in the election. However, most Republicans have remained silent and avoided congratulating Biden's victory. They keep supporting President Donald Trump, saying that he should keep fighting for changing the election results. Trump plans to legally challenge the election results. He accused Democrats of stealing the vote result and election meddling in swing states.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence. But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. Pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
The European Union presses ahead with plans to impose tariffs on up to $4 billion worth of U.S. goods and services. The EU's top trade official says the tariffs will be imposed over illegal American support for plane maker Boeing. Last year, the World Trade Organization authorized the U.S. to slap penalties on EU goods worth up to $7.5 billion. It was over European support for Boeing rival Airbus. Now the EU says it remains open for a negotiated solution for both sides to withdraw the tariffs. Trade tensions have been mounting between the U.S. and the European Union over the past couple years, with the Trump administration trying to reduce U.S. trade deficits through tariffs. Jerome Hughes says that a trade deal between the U.S. and the EU is possible after Joe Biden swears in as the U.S. president.
The European Commission has always said that it remains and stands ready to withdraw new tariffs that it imposes once the United States does the same, because it's saying that it's only reciprocating what the U.S. is doing. And you know, of course, all of this is happening against the backdrop of the change in the administration. And I think there can be little doubt that when Joe Biden gets into office next year, that things will normalize and relations will improve. This is such an important foreign policy issue for the European Union, for any country, really. I mean, it's the most important foreign policy issue when we're talking about trade, apart from security, if you're being threatened by another country or whatever. But, you know, this is because this is all the money is involved here for the European Union. And, of course, it's a big issue for the United States. So I think what will happen is, you know, the EU side wants no tariffs with the US. They want a trade deal with the United States. And I think it is quite possible now, with Joe Biden coming into power, that we're going to see a situation whereby in the coming couple of years, we could have a trade deal between the EU and the US.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says it lacks funds to pay the salaries of its employees. UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East says it needs to raise $70 million by the end of the month to be able to pay full salaries for the months of November and December. The funding shortfall affects 28,000 staffers in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, among other places in the region. The agency's spokesman said that UNRWA never recovered from the total funding cut imposed by Donald Trump's administration in 2018. Tamara Al-Rifai expressed optimism that U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's administration will restore Washington's annual $300 million aid. UNRWA runs schools and provides health services, as well as other humanitarian aid, to an estimated 5.7 million Palestinian refugees. Last month, Sudan's transitional government agreed to normalize ties with the Israeli regime following the UAE and Bahrain's footsteps. This after the U.S. agreed to remove the African state from its terrorism blacklist and offered it financial aid in exchange. The move has drawn anger from the Muslim world and Palestinians, who have called it a stab in their back. Earlier, we were joined by Ahmed Caballo in Khartoum to get more updates about this issue.
One of the things that the transitional government is saying is, we are just doing this in transition. A future democratically elected government can obviously reverse this decision. And what they're saying is because the political opposition parties are so annoyed by this decision, and it's likely not to pass the Legislative Council, whenever the Legislative Council is eventually formed. It's already overdue. So one of the ways to kind of sweeten the deal is by saying, listen, this is just a temporary thing. When a democratically elected government comes, they can reverse that decision. But as any kind of commentators and analysts of the political arena know, that once the motion is set in place, that it's very hard to reverse that motion. Once ties begin, once flights begin, once visas are issued, then it's a very difficult thing to reverse. So it's a way of kind of appeasing those that are opposing this decision to normalize relations with Israel, but I don't think it will work. And at the moment, there is stiff opposition, and Hamdok hasn't exactly explained to the people how he's reversed this decision, what's the process that's led him to reverse this decision. Everyone knows that it's because of the economic crisis.
The joint developers of the new coronavirus vaccine say that it has been 90% effective in preventing new infections in the final stage of its trials. Germany's BioNTech and the U.S.'s Pfizer said this is a critical milestone at a time when the world needs the vaccine the most. The companies say that they expect to supply up to 50 million vaccine doses globally by the end of the year and up to 1.3 billion next year. U.S. President Donald Trump, whose election defeat is partially blamed on his lame response to the pandemic, hailed the vaccines as great news. The U.S. President-elect Joe Biden also hailed the vaccine as a cause for hope, but he warned that defeating the coronavirus pandemic is still a months-long battle, stressing on the importance of wearing masks as the U.S. continues to reel from the virus. The coronavirus pandemic has badly hit the European economy. France is one of the countries suffering from a recession due to pandemic-related lockdowns. We discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program.
In this edition of the News Review, the French Central Bank predicts a decline of up to 10% in the country's economic activity in 2020. The plunge, which is bigger than previously expected, results from a newly imposed COVID-19 restriction. The Central Bank estimates that the nation's gross domestic product will contract 12% compared to a normal week in November. Services requiring direct contact with customers are expected to be the hardest hit, with a 40% decline in their services. The new restrictions came into effect on October 30th to curb the coronavirus surge in France. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in Paris, Kristen Hund, and also Dr. Steve Keane, author of Debunking Economics out of Bangkok. Thanks to both of you gentlemen. Let's start with our correspondent in Paris to give us an update. Can you tell us more about the different aspects of this piece of news that we have received?
Well, the figures of the central bank are minus 10% economic growth for the entire year 2020, which confirms former forecast of the INSEE, which is the National Institute of Statistics. They preview minus 10%, even minus 13%. All this is due to the severe measures taken due to the second wave of the coronavirus. So there is a second lockdown, which is rather severe and affects mostly bars, restaurants, hotels, and also recreation sectors. However, the difference with the first wave, the first lockdown earlier this year, is that schools, primary and secondary schools, remain open. That allows parents to go to work with a focus on work at home. So it means that other sectors like construction and public services are less affected. However, a negative growth of minus 10%, it's really huge, and there is an unemployment rate of plus 10%, and poverty is really rising at this moment.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to Mr. Keane from Bangkok. Mr. Keane, did European governments, and France in particular, have better choices or better options, say, economically speaking, in order to not to put so much pressure on the economy?
Well, no, in a word, because this disease spreads by human contact, as we know, particularly in enclosed environments with low circulation of air. Now, of course, you know, Europe going into winter right now, that is almost the definition of a European workplace. And the only way to prevent it is to enable people not to suffer from the financial consequences, that the government has to provide cash flow that enables people who are not working in essential tasks not to work but still not go bankrupt because of that. But you really have to shut down most of the forms of economic activity which involve people congregating indoors in badly aerated environments.
But Mr. Keane, the reason why I'm asking you this is that we've seen other countries not taking such drastic measures, even in Europe, Sweden, for example, and their economy is quite fine, and on the other hand, they don't have that many severe coronavirus cases either.
That's not true. Sweden, when you take a look at the level of the fall in GDP versus the number of deaths and number of recorded cases, Sweden is at the high end of both. in terms of the economic impact. People, if the government doesn't trigger the lockdown, but you still know you have a 1 in 20 chance of getting a disease which can kill you if you're the right age group, you don't go out, you don't go to work. So there's an internal tendency for people not to lock down. For lockdown, even if the government tells them, don't worry. I'm currently in Thailand because Thailand executed a very intelligent process of lockdown of all except essential activities, which really means people producing food, electricity, and the internet. And as a result of that, a country of 65 million has had less than 4,000 cases. So, and is now back to pretty much normal activity, except for the absence of international tourism. So you simply have to do a lockdown while we still don't have an effective vaccine, and you have to do an effective lockdown. Anything which is half-baked, particularly during winter in Europe, is going to end up with just as many cases after it within a matter of weeks, given how contagious this virus is.
Thank you very much. Back to Chris, our correspondent in Paris. Now, Chris, as we just heard our other guest from Bangkok, obviously the French government has no other choice, but how do you think this economic impact can be less severe?
The main problem with the French government is they did not apply a massive testing in the beginning of the COVID crisis. And now, as it is too late, they postponed as far as possible the second measures of the due to the second wave, though, so a second lockdown. But due to the massive casualties in patients and also deaths, I mean, last 24 hours, 60,000 new cases. It's a new record. 306 new deaths due to the COVID crisis. The French government has been obliged to apply the second lockdown measures and is thinking about even making it more severe. The reason why the French government is not making it more severe is a fear, a panic of an economic bankrupt.
Thank you very much, Dr. Steve Keen, author of Debunking Economics out of Bangkok, and our correspondent, Kristen Hund, out of Paris. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your elaborations, and thanks to all of us for following this edition of the News Review.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will explore how people and government of India see and react to the normalization of relations with Israel.
The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have formally established diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime in deals brokered and promulgated by the US President Donald Trump. Palestinians have decried the move as a grave betrayal to the people and cause of Palestine, saying that formalizing ties with the Zionist regime further undermines efforts to achieve self-determination. However, the American president says that there are several other Arab states that are willing to go public with their Israeli affairs.
Some Arab countries are formally normalizing their relations with Israel. Most Muslims around the world are against it, and there are regular protests against the move in numerous countries, whether the respective governments support it or not. Evidently, the Indian government supports it, which is quite against the common spirit of the majority of the people in the subcontinent, and not only the Muslims.
It's despicable, sad, condemnable, unfortunate. And whatever we can say about this relation between Arab and Israel is beyond words.
As far as Indian Muslims are concerned, they have already expressed their strong condemnation about the recent normalization of the ties between Israel and UAE.
If you talk about Indian perspective, not just the Indian Muslims, but the Indian people at large have been and will always be with the Palestinian cause and have always condemned Israel and its aggression.
U.S. President Donald Trump was the force behind the agreement for the UAE and Bahrain to establish normal diplomatic relations with Israel. The day after Trump announced the deal, UAE Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan briefed Indian External Affairs Minister Subrahmanyam Jaishankar about the move in a telephone call that the minister really appreciated. The timing of the proclamation seems suspiciously beneficial for Trump's re-election, as both Israel and UAE want him back in the White House. Trump wants to sell the agreement as a diplomatic victory in his campaign and tries to brand it Abraham Accord, as Abraham was father of all three great faiths.
The agreement is a part of a broader re-election show by Trump and his administration, who earlier this year revealed the so-called Middle East peace plan, which was categorically rejected by the Palestinians as well as other countries of the region. Even if Trump loses the elections, UAE is not likely to face any major diplomatic repercussions, as the Democratic hopeful Joe Biden has also welcomed the deal, cluelessly calling it a historic step to bridge the deep divides of the Middle East.
Some Arab states of the Persian Gulf had already established covert ties with Israel, so why is now the time to risk and go public about them? The UAE and Bahrain are the third and fourth Arab state after Egypt and Jordan to have opened diplomatic lines. If Abu Dhabi and Manama do not face any serious consequences, the move may serve as a catalyst for other states to follow suit. Trump has even more re-election stunts on his list and is pushing more countries such as Sudan and Oman toward Israel. India's reaction to the agreement is not surprising, as all the three nations behind the move have become close partners of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi government. Israel and India have enjoyed close relations in recent years, and Modi has also been able to cultivate strong relations with the UAE. India sees this as a potentially positive sign, as the normalization may create a more favorable political environment for its interests in the Middle East.
Now, to add more insight, we are joined by Mr. Vijay Prasad, who is a historian, journalist, and director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He is also the author of the book Namaste Sharon, Hindutva and Sharonism under U.S. Hegemony. Mr. Prasad, welcome to the subcontinent. So, in the past few decades, there have been many reports exposing Arab-Israeli backchannel links. Why have they decided to formalize their relations now?
You see, now, and when you talk about Arab, you mean mainly the United Arab Emirates. And we need to understand that there is an increased tension between the UAE and Turkey over a range of issues. On the one side, their battle over Libya. On the other side, their battle over gas fields in the Eastern Mediterranean. Turkey and the UAE have been struggling with each other over certain resources and regions in the greater North African, West Asian region. I have a feeling that the UAE, seeking to get European and American backing for its project, essentially normalized with Israel as a way to curry favor and therefore to put pressure on Turkey. There's no way the UAE can confront Turkey directly. So this is a way to get diplomatic favor in Washington, D.C., perhaps in Paris and so on, and allow that pressure to be put on Turkey so that Turkey backs off in, you know, on the one side in Libya, and on the other side in the very important energy battles taking place in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay, you're focusing on UAE, but Bahrain has also normalized relations with Israel recently, and Oman is in the pipeline. And you're saying that India is supporting this move because it wants to put pressure on Turkey and gain favors from the U.S. So does the Indian government support the normalization of relations between Israel and Arab states?
It's hard to say whether the Indian government directly supports the normalization, because India, as you know, plays a double game here. On the one hand, India has normalized with Israel and started that process in 91-92. On the other hand, India is a little careful, even under the Narendra Modi government, of too direct statements regarding the issue of Palestine or Israel, so as not to jeopardize relations mainly with Saudi Arabia, because there's a feeling that Saudi Arabia, a big energy provider to India, might not like it if India is too much public about its support for Israel. So India generally keeps a sort of double game here and hasn't come out directly and said we support the UAE or we don't support the UAE. I mean, in that sense, silence on this is to India's benefit.
Now, Mr. Prasad, our team has collected global media coverage in this regard, and we would like you to take a look on that, and then we can continue with the question answer session.
Historic as this moment is, it's worth looking at the larger geopolitical forces at work here and the short-term and long-term calculations of the key players involved. In the Machiavellian world of the Middle East, nothing is as clear-cut as it first appears. That's why it's also important that India play its cards carefully as it comes to terms with a changing Middle East. The fog over the emerging realignments in the region has officially lifted. India's strategic partnership with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE is a major pillar of India's relationship with the West Asian region. This partnership will be strengthened. With India's growing ties to the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, and ties with Iran and Turkey floundering over the Kashmir issue, the agreement will buttress Delhi's ties with the region.
Thank you for staying with us, Mr. Prasad, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Prasad, you earlier said that India is playing a double game. How can the Indian government support the Palestinian cause and Israel at the same time? Isn't it hypocritical? How is it possible?
To support the Palestinian cause and to support Israel at the same time is simply not possible, because in a sense, the Israeli project is about the annihilation of the Palestinian project. So you can't support both, I'm afraid. In this case, one has to make a choice. And India has effectively chosen to stand with Israel in terms of the Israel colonization of the Palestinian people, their life and land and so on. India has made a choice, but it doesn't want to too publicly declare that choice, even though it's made the choice. There'll be some small gestures vis-a-vis the Palestinians. The Indians will go and say, we'll invest in some project in the Palestinian Authority and so on. Small gestures will be made. But by and large, I think India, like many of the Gulf Arab countries, have made their choice and they have decided to stand with Israel against the Palestinian people.
So you're saying that India has made a choice and sided with Israel. So has India abandoned its Gandhian values?
Time ago that Gandhi, Nehru and others made clear their support for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. You know, that was the era of anti-colonialism and struggles, and in a sense what the Palestinians were facing, what they were struggling with, was the struggle of anti-colonialism. You know, they wanted to free themselves from colonialism. This lasts all the way out till the 1980s in India, this support for the anti-colonial struggle. Yasser Arafat, for instance, comes to Delhi in 1983, is met at the airport by Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister. He says that she is my sister. I mean, you know, they were very close relations. The Palestinian Liberation Organization had an office in Delhi. But after India decided to normalize with the United States, actually, first, it was told you have to normalize with Israel. And that is the big shift. When the Soviet Union collapses, it was catastrophic for non-aligned policy. It was catastrophic for third world solidarity. It was catastrophic for the Palestinians. I mean, the PLO went and surrendered, essentially, at Oslo. during the Oslo Accords, those agreements. So, you know, it's not just India that surrendered its support for the Palestinians, but the PLO also in some ways surrendered its own views at Oslo. And that was a sign of the times. And sadly, a new kind of international support for the Palestinian cause has not been properly built up. This is greatly lacking.
Out of more than 190 member states of the United Nations, nearly 140 recognize the state of Palestine, and about 160 also recognize Israel. This means a lot of the governments in the world have relations with both the occupier and the occupied. But when Arab countries connive with the US to establish former ties with the Zionist regime, many other countries feel emboldened to defend their Israeli ties.
India's official stand about Israel has always been somehow paradoxically, yet conveniently supple. In 2014, India chose to pursue a de-hyphenation policy aiming to deal with both Israel and Palestine in an independent manner. In 2017, India voted against recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and then again in 2018, New Delhi decided to review its Palestine policy when the Palestinian ambassador to Pakistan was photographed, along with the chief of Lashkar-e-Taiba, a militant group blamed for the 2008 Mumbai siege. While Palestine calls this a betrayal that blows up every possibility for peace, India welcomes the full normalization of ties between UAE and Israel, calling both key strategic partners. New Delhi says it still continues its traditional support for the Palestinian cause. But how? It seems that the Middle East has more than enough sand for everybody to bury their heads in. Otherwise, the world would notice such inconsistent and constantly changing policies. Israel, UAE, and the US claim the normalization is an exchange of Tel Aviv suspending its annexation of Palestinian territories. But from the Palestinian point of view, the UAE and Bahrain have destroyed any hopes of establishing an independent state with this move that can never slow Israeli expansionism.
This step is very dangerous step because it will encourage some other countries in order to normalize their relation with Israel, which is not normal, which is against our religion, which is against our history.
Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French. This Mahatma Gandhi's 1938 remark about Palestine is the most quoted utterance in any literature of India's foreign policy. The first blow to Gandhian values was in 1992, when India reversed its four-decade-old policy of recognition without relations and normalized relations with the Israeli regime. Now, with India's support for the normalization of ties with Israel, Gandhi's statement that Palestine belongs to the Arabs is further losing its relevance.
Several pundits believe it is not surprising, not even a big deal, that a number of Arab countries are going public with their previously covert ties with Israel, as some others, including India, stand and applaud. Formalized relations with Israel probably guarantee garnering bipartisan favor with the United States. And the U.S. approval means a green light for authoritarian governments to suppress all different voices and domestic challenges with less chance of international pressure. Thanks to formalizing relations with Israel, Bahrain's Al Khalifa family have acquired an influential ally in its fight against domestic opposition. This can also be true for Saudi Arabia, which is still gauging the prospects of normalization, since Riyadh seeks to nip the bud for political liberalization that would challenge the legitimacy of the ruling Al Saud monarchy, including demands for change from its own repressed Shia minority. The Indian government longs for such an opportunity. India has compelling reasons to feel optimistically comfortable, but its open support for Israeli relations may put its own interests and dealings at stake in the Middle East. If New Delhi puts all its eggs in the Arab basket, Islamabad may align itself more closely with Tehran and Ankara, all in the backdrop of growing Iran-China and Pakistan-Iran ties.
For more analysis, we are now joined by Dr. Tasleem Ahmed Rahmani, who is the president of Muslim Political Council of India and the national secretary of Social Democratic Party of India. Dr. Rahmani, welcome to the show. So, how do the Indian people, especially the 200 million Muslims, view these Arab countries formalizing ties with Israel?
You see, the Indian Muslims are traditionally and historically against the Israel and with standing always with the Palestinian cause. They still, the general public, and there is no change in their stand, in their policy towards Palestine and towards Israel. We have always taken Israel as a traitor country, as an occupier, and as a terrorist state. And we still, at our public level, general public level, we still do that stand, and very vociferously. We are here to boycott the Israeli product, and our Union government still towards the pro-Israeli policy is being strongly condemned by the Indian Muslims because we take it as an occupier.
Okay, so you're saying that people side with the Palestinian cause and condemn the support of the Indian government for Israel. India has strong economic ties with Arab countries. Do you see this as a weight on the Indian government to support Arab normalization with Israel?
Yes, indeed. You see the change in India. It's a fascist regime. We always termed it as a fascist regime, as a saffronized and a right-wing, a radicalized political party is the BJP. And after the BJP has taken over, they have just opened up their relationship with Israel. Most of our security installations, our business ties, economic ties, agriculture sector, power sector, telecommunication sector, the government of India has a big tie-up with the Israeli government. And ideologically, this BJP, RSS, and Israel policy has an affinity, and they stand at the same pedestal. That's why the strong bonding between India and Israel has repercussions on the Indo-Arab relationship. So as far as the Arab countries are coming closer to Israel, the India is also becoming closer to those Muslim countries or Arab countries which are coming closer to Israel. That's why they praise UAE, they praise Saudi Arab, and some of such Gulf countries. While this is a fact that our relationship, as far as our foreign policy is concerned, our relation with Saudi Arab was not very cordial. It was just a normal relationship we always maintained with Saudi Arab and other such Gulf countries. But after this change in regime and the shift in foreign policy, these relationship has become more cordial just because of the relationship with Israel are coming more, the diplomatic relation is coming more closer with those Gulf rulers. That's obviously the government of India has taken a step towards them, and they have made their bonding much more stronger just because of Israel.
Now, Dr. Rahmani, let's just quickly take a look at how global media has covered this issue, and then we can continue with the questions.
In late November 2019, there was widespread outrage over a video of the Indian Consul General in New York, Sandeep Chakravorty, in which he suggested to a gathering of Kashmiri Hindus that India should follow the Israeli model and build settlements in the Kashmir Valley to secure the return of Hindus. Kashmiri activists and journalists were shocked by his apparent support for Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. But this is only one of many recent examples of a growing political love affair between India and Israel. Retired Indian Foreign Service officer Navdeep Suri, who had been India's ambassador to UAE until late 2019, has told The Wire that the trends towards the normalization of ties between Israel and UAE had been clearly discernible in the last couple of years as the two were driven by their joint antipathy towards Iran.
All right, Dr. Rahmani, welcome back to the show. So you're saying that the Indian government loves Israel and is therefore supporting the Arab countries who are formalizing their relations with the Israeli regime. India has a history of supporting Palestinian cause. Has anything changed there in India with this regard?
You see, Gandhian values, Gandhi, Congress, and Muslims, and so many other groups like the liberals, the communists, social organizations, they were always pro-Palestine, pro-Gandhian. This regime, and particularly this ideology, RSS pose, they claim today that they are actually the Gandhian. While they do not belong to Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy, they are actually the killers of Gandhi, and not only the killer of Gandhi, they are the killer of Gandhian ideology. But because Gandhi is a tallest icon in our nation, and no regime can go further without taking the name of Gandhi. That's why the present establishment try to show that they are also Gandhian, and that's why otherwise they have nothing to do with Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy actually. That so there is a shift in the Israel and Palestine policy, but that doesn't mean that the Gandhi or Gandhi ideology has tilted towards that policy. This is a fraud and this is a farce that this RSS and BJP try to pose that they are also Gandhian. No, they are not Gandhians. They take advantage of, but you must understand that the general public, the normal population of India, they are pro-Palestinian till today. There is not a single day goes by when we don't find a report, a positive report about Palestine in our print media, particularly the Urdu media. There is not a single day passed when we don't have a report about the Gaza people, about the Hamas people, about the plights of Palestine. So the general population, and not only Muslim, rather the social groups, the secularist groups, they are still standing with the Palestine in the same way we used to stand before 2014. But this regime was against Palestine even before coming to the power. They are still against Palestine. They will remain against Palestine always because they are right-winger radicalized people.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the issue of normalization of ties with the Zionist regime and India's stance towards it. We'll meet next week.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge, exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Of course, we are discussing about the qualities of the pious based on the sermon number 184, and we reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Yamzujul hilma bil ilm," that a pious person is one who couples forbearance with knowledge. Forbearance, of course, is that situation where a person is harmed or is dislikes something, and something that is hurtful or something that is bad happens to him, something that causes dislike to him, distaste to him, and he controls that state, that is called hilm, forbearance. Of course, controlling the anger is one of the examples or one of the you can say instances of forbearance. Forbearance in general is something, a state where a person, when something that is not palatable to his state, to his feelings, to a person's feelings, and you know those states, he controls them. He keeps them. He keeps that his state in control. That is called forbearance.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that يَمْزُجُ الْحِلْمَ بِالْعِلْمِ, he mixes or he couples forbearance with knowledge. Now, in the previous session we explained that when it comes to coupling or bringing together forbearance with knowledge, what we mean here is that a person, when he shows forbearance, that forbearance should be together with knowledge. It should not be out of ignorance, because then he will be taken advantage of in life. Forbearance in and of itself is not a laudable quality in and of itself. It has to be with knowledge. Then only it creates it has value. Otherwise it can be a destructive force. It can be something that can rather cause problems and difficulties in the social life, and a lot of other forms of destruction. If you see in various narrations, we have that whenever the discussion of forbearance is brought before that, the discussion of knowledge is there. So for example, in one of the narrations from Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says that is reportedly to have said, أن العلم خليل المؤمن والحلم وزيره, that the knowledge is a close friend of a believer, and forbearance is his advisor. Okay, or for example, one of the other places where the qualities of the pious people was mentioned previously, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَعِلْمًا فِي حِلْمٍ, we see that he has knowledge in his forbearance. Or for example, another narration from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, where he says that إِنَّمَا شِيعَةُ عَلِيٍ الْحُلَمَاءَ الْعُلَمَاءَ, the followers of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the Shia of Imam Ali alayhi salam, are patient, are forbearing, and they are ulama, they are knowledgeable. So notice, he doesn't just say they are forbearing, but he also says that they are knowledgeable. That means that forbearance is mixed with that knowledge. And it is a very sad reality in the history of the oppressive nations of the world, if you notice, that wherever they entered, they preached forbearance. They've preached to be patient and kind and loving, but they didn't teach the people their rights.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, based on what I said previously, if you notice the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, whenever or normally when they talk about forbearance, they bring knowledge together with it. It's a very important lesson that the Imams are trying to teach us here. Notice that in the history of colonialism and the way the colonialists entered into different countries, they, of course, preached morality. But look at the crooked version of morality that they preached. They preached forbearance, they preached kindness, they preached love, they preached all of these things, but they did not preach about the rights of human beings. They didn't tell the human beings that God has given you the right to govern yourselves, to decide your future. So they taught them one dimension of human life, and that was to be forbearant, to have forbearance, to be patient, making them subservient creatures that could be controlled by others. So this is very important. It is very important that a person understands the basis of morality in political issues. And that is what Imam Ali Salam here is telling us, that al-hilm wal-ilm. So for example, in another narration from the Ahlul Bayt, we have min alamat al-fiqh al-hilm wal-ilm was-samt. That forbearance together with knowledge and lack of speech or silence. Or for example, in another narration we have, the Ahlul Bayt have taught us this dua, where of course the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam would recite this dua, Allahumma aghnini bil ilm wa zayyini bil hilm. That, oh Allah, make me independent through your knowledge and beautify me with forbearance. Look at the stress that is given on knowledge, that knowledge is the one that leads you to have that state of independence, which is the most important part, and then beautify me with forbearance. Forbearance has a beautifying aspect which would lose its color if a person is subservient and dependent. So you'll see also in other narrations this is there. In the different narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And as such, it is important for us to pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this state, that He gives us a correct understanding about morality and helps us to have that forbearance together with knowledge and true understanding of what our rights are. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.